Welcome to the Agile Revolution. This is Craig. We're at the Yow West Conference in Perth in Western Australia, and two non-Western Australians sitting here, but it's my great pleasure to have Marcus Hammerberg sitting with me. How are you doing, Marcus?
I'm just fine. Good to see you, Greg.
Did I pronounce that correct?
Marcus Hammerberg.
There you go. Got that correct. So if you're wondering, you know the name from somewhere, he's one of the co-authors of one of the better books, in fact, I would say it's the best book on Kanban, but one of my top 10 reads in Agile, and I've spoken about it on the podcast before, Kanban in Action. So congratulations on an awesome book.
Thank you, and thank you for saying such nice things about the book. We worked really hard on it for a very long time. Non-Agile process of writing it, though.
Yeah, I think book writing has a lot to learn from our process. I was actually looked up the website because I'd actually forgotten I was on the back page of this book, but this was my quote on the book, and this is what I feel like. And I said, "No mucking around gets the heart of Kanban from the first page, a must read."
Thank you, sir.
So there you go. So go buy the book. Just great to have you in Perth. Now, you're originally from Europe?
Yeah, so I'm from Sweden, mm-hmm. Stockholm, Sweden. That's where I normally work. But
so
now
home of Abba and Volvos and here.
Yeah, exactly. And Volvo is on the other side of the country, so it's a little bit of a grudge between west and east coast of Sweden. But we love Volvo, and we have much to learn from that industry as well. But, so I'm originally from there, working as an IT consultant, mostly around the Agile things. And my thing for Agile, as you've seen in the book, is I'm a very practical guy. So everything I learn and teach, I want to bring down to practical matters, how to make this actually work. Mm-hmm. So that's the goal for everything I do around that. Now for 3 years I'm in this neck of the woods, as you say, in this part of the world, in Indonesia actually, in a town called Bandung that I never heard of before I left, and it's about the same size as Sweden.
Right.
So it's a big town. I work for the Salvation Army there, and it's very non-IT. I help hospital and managers at hospitals to become a little more effective. So it's non-IT, but it's very lean inspired, agile inspired, and I apply a lot of the Kanban principles in what we do there as well.
Excellent. We got Kanban when David J. Anderson, he brought Kanban to us from manufacturing and gym. And it's interesting now that we've kind of got it working in software, it's almost like we're giving it back again.
Yeah, exactly. No. And maybe that's how things have evolved in many industries. I think that we are borrowing from different things, but I've yet to introduce Kanban to anyone without them saying, but this could be applied in X. And so I have a friend that his wife is a teacher, so she has Kanban boards for each student in their room, and I was like, yeah, perfect. That's exactly what it is. You can use that perfectly there as well. Really good for kids, actually, especially that visualization, tactile, you can move stuff. We had a Kanban board limiting the number of hours they can watch TV each week in our family for a while. Didn't work, though. They ate the magnets.
Yeah, blew out the worker person.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
How'd you get started in this whole thing? I'm always interested to see how people fall into the Agile community.
I've searched my soul for coming up with that, but basically I was a programmer from the beginning, and I did a lot of consultancy, and for some reason I ended up like managing the little group that we were in, and then at one big insurance company, me and a colleague, Øystein and I, we heard about Scrum. So Ken Schreiber was coming to Stockholm, and we said, this sounds cool. Basically off the name, actually. Mm-hmm. And we just went to the Scrum Master course, and we were totally hooked. So we just started doing that, and we ran a project. It was very interesting. It was one of the most humiliating experiences of my life. The first sprint was 3 weeks. We were 12 people, a huge team, so we split that up after a while, but we were 12 people in the team. And what we produced was basically you could double click an icon and the application open, and we verified your identity in the frame, in mainframe. 3 weeks. So we were like, yeah, this is not good. And we got to do the demo because we followed the rules, right? So we did the demo after 3 weeks and they said, Marcus, you demo. Because this was embarrassing. Everyone was embarrassed. And I still remember a long table and three important guys in the end, right? And I demoed that. It took about 20 seconds. And then I said, yeah, this is what we built in 3 weeks. And they were reaction. I've never got that before or after. They were unanimously standing up and giving us a spontaneous applause. And we were like, what happened? And they never seen things move that fast before in that company. Mm. So they were overjoyed by the fact that something moved.
Mm.
So that's when I got really hooked into it. The continuation of that story is why I got hooked on maybe Agile and Lean, because we ran maybe 10 sprints and then we were done. So we said, we're done. Great, said the company. Now is the testing phase. So testing, we didn't have testers in the team. We haven't thought about that.
Mm.
So, and we ran into a testing phase of 3 months and then we said, oh, okay, now we're done.
Mm.
Yeah, great. So you just missed the deployment train. So we had another one in 3 months. We waited another 3 months, but that was not the problem. The big problem was that we learned that they wrote the requirements of the system 1.5 years before we even started.
So you're doing water scrum, waterfall.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm.
And in that experience, I also realized that that we did sprints in the middle that aims for nothing. It didn't give us a thing. We had fun and we moved fast, but we produced ready for testing. So that started my journey really, and I got very interested in agile testing because we brought testers in and that failed miserably because they were testing non-agile and we were producing agile, so they were about to kill us before we.
It's very interesting. That mirrors my experience exactly.
Yeah.
We got, you know, we from the particularly from the development side as developers, we got really keen, and I think it was just that. I don't know what you think, but 2001, I think, was that watershed moment. I think if they had written the manifesto a couple of years earlier, it would never have taken off.
Mm.
But the internet, you know, so we could actually get at it. You know, Y2K had just kind of been around, and we all said never again.
Mm.
And so, you know, we embraced it, but. Yeah, we've got to bring the analysts and testers along for the ride. So we got really good at, you know, taking things and putting them in the story cards and delivering it out. But, you know, the testing is something that's, it's matured a lot now. And, you know, I know you speak about BDD and the like in some of your other talks. But, yeah, it's one of the things that was a late bloomer to the...
Yeah, I totally agree. And I often describe Agile as that, especially when I talk to business people, because... If you and I have heard some people call Agile the like a liberation movement for developers, and that's how it started. But if we compare how we write code nowadays to how we wrote code before Agile, so to speak, it's a totally different game. And we do some things that would be considered crazy. Write the test before you write the code. And stuff like that, right? Mm. Or write microservices that we talk about now. Really? Why? And then testers started a few years after, sadly, which has caused a lot of problems. But they also test in a completely different way. The role tester is a different job now. Many things that the tester used to do is now automated. Deployment, the same thing. So when I talk to business people, I tell them the stories that how we from the bottom of the reasoning we do have changed almost everything we do in order to fit it in smaller iterations. And we heard Fred George at this conference talking about some iterations nowadays, they are like 30 minutes.
Mm.
And you deploy several times a day, even for the very big sites.
Thousands of times a day, if you're a Facebook or a Netflix.
Yeah, exactly. So now we need to talk with the business and have them like tag along. And this is where I found that speaking about Agile with business has a little bit, it's a little bit techy to me because it came from tech, which is sad. And often we say for the Agile Manifesto that it was middle-aged white men, right? Yeah, there were developers, some testers, but there's none there that talked about business.
Mm.
So no wonder that we have a little hard time to communicate with them around this. So mostly I talk about Lean, or I prefer not to talk about any kind of method and just say, let's make it better, let's go faster, let's move faster. And so that's and that's also what I find is really interesting. My second talk here at Yahoo West is about impact mapping, and it's a perfect tool for that kind of discussion, because that really makes sense to me.
It actually came from your part of the world too, I believe, talking to Goiko. He stole it from the Swedish or something.
Exactly. It's a Swedish company called In Use, and a woman called Ingrid Dominguez that has pioneered that. She didn't call it impact maps, she called it effect maps, I think. Very interesting technology, and the tool rather. Yeah, it has nothing to do with technology.
Yeah.
And that's another thing. The first time I came to Indonesia, the first thing I did was actually to create impact map for one of our hospitals.
Mm.
How to increase the numbers of patients. It was a perfect fit. We had a really good discussion around that. And the outcomes, the things that we were doing, had nothing to do with IT. It was like moving walls maybe, or train nurses or stuff like that.
Mm. I guess, it's like everything though, you're looking for an impact, and particularly when you talk about healthcare.
No
bigger impact than people's health.
No, exactly. Mm. So,
what about the whole Kanban thing? I mean, where did the idea for the book come from? Because, I mean, there's a lot of Kanban books out there. I usually recommend Henrik's book for people who are moving from Scrum to Kanban. Very good, lots of pictures, and it's free, so usually get
first
people across
book I read, first book I read about it.
And of course you got David J. Anderson's Kanban book. Mm. You really want to get serious and get into all the principles and rules and all those type of things. And he's moved on now from modern management methods, which I think is a stupid name, but personally, sorry, David. how did the book come about? Was it just that you had a story that needed to be told?
The thing is, me and Joachim that wrote the book, and another colleague called Christoph Ashwan, we worked at the same company, and we created like an introduction course to Kanban. And basically what Joachim and I did was we spent 8 hours in a room photographing different states on a Kanban board, and we made like a very simple animation. It was a bit boring, but very, very fun in the end, because it really works, and that has proven very effective. You saw my presentation yesterday. Just seeing stuff move makes it like,
and particularly the pull mechanism.
Yeah, exactly.
I did the same thing in my course. I've got an animation where I show people pull, and particularly when you got those sub states. When something's done, you don't just push it into the next barrier to chug somebody up. If that fills up, then you go and help your buddies.
So we did that course, and we taught it to a couple of local people, and then we uploaded the slides to SlideShare. It's around 80,000 views now, which is like mind-blowing to me. And I blog a lot at my blog in around Kanban. So one day I got an email from Manny, and they wrote the email in a way that I thought that they had someone writing a book in Kanban and wanted my like criticism on his thing. So I had a very casual talk with someone there, and they just said, "So what do you think should go into a book of Kanban?" And I like, so this is the thing that we talked about. And I also said that basically the Bible on Kanban is already written by the guy that brought it into Kanban, so you can't really compete to that. So what I said there, and that was also the approach we took for the book, it was like, you have to take a completely different angle on it. And then after 40 minutes of casual talking, he blurts out, "So when do you want to start? When do you want to start write that book for us?" And I was totally shocked. So I didn't see that coming at all. So two questions popped into my mind. The first one was, I need to call you, Joachim, right after this and say, we have to do this together, I'm not doing it. That proved really great, but also extremely frustrating. I think I finished the book maybe a year faster without Joachim, but it would be crap.
Mm.
So I'd rather do it this way, even though it was super frustrating.
So peer writing is what you're saying.
Yeah, it was hard. I would not recommend that actually, but the outcome was really good once we were done. We are still friends as well, so.
Excellent. Well,
no shared knowing. And the second question was like, I felt that, who am I to write about this? But after a while, I just realized, I'll do it on my take. So that brings us back to the very practical stuff. So we all, from the outset, we said, let's start super practical, let's start and spoon feed the theory as needed. instead of doing a bulk of theory and then say this is how we implement it, we just turn the concept.
And I think that was interestingly, and you know, I'll be honest with you, when I read the first chapter,
yeah,
I read the first chapter and I went, what the heck just happened here?
Yeah.
Because I'm following along, it's a story of people meeting you at a conference,
yeah,
and they say, "Hey, we just saw your presentation, and we want to, you know, we want to, you know, teach us about this Kanban thing." So you drag them into a room, and say, "Pay us some money, and then we'll, you know, that kind of thing." And you take them through the journey of visualizing their work. And I get to the end of the first chapter, and I went, "Okay, so he's explained Kanban. What the heck now?" And I almost wanted to put the book down, and then I went, yeah, but it was that curiosity that I went and read the next chapter, and then you just take it and you take people on that journey. And that's what I really love about it is that, and even in your talk yesterday, the thing I really loved is you get this notion of bus stops,
yeah,
right? And that's how the book reads, is, yeah, that, you know, you can get to a chapter and you go, I've learned enough, you can put it back on the shelf, you can come back to the book, you know, months later and go, I'm ready for the next bit now.
Yeah, so that's exactly what we wanted. So we are both, both me and Joachim are fans of the Gold, of Ilya Goldratt, that I can recommend to anyone. And that entire book is a novel.
Mm.
So the theory of constraints that book is about is really boring, but the reason you keep reading is that it's an intriguing story.
Mm.
So we wanted like a quick overview of Kanban in the form of a story. So you're basically just flipping through it, and I think it's like 46 pages, but it's a lot of pictures as well. So our goal was that you could read this in less than an hour. And that's the one of the chapters that we give away for free, so you can just get it. And then, exactly as you said, our plan was that after that we have a few chapters describing the basics, with a very practical take on it. And then we want the book to be like a reference book. So, because Kanban in itself is very, very simple, but there's a lot of practices around it, and you will not use all of them.
Mm.
So maybe you run into, okay, so we need different types of work here. We need to classify them. Okay, you can look up that chapter and deep dive into that, and probably we give some pointers to other things. So now we come to measurements. Okay, we have a chapter on that, so you can deep dive in that. But I think the best experience is probably to do exactly what you said. Read the first chapter and get like basic knowledge, and then deep dive into things that you think is more interesting, and keep the book next to your board, so you can flip through it and get some inspiration or be challenged.
Absolutely. I think one of the things you spoke about in your talk yesterday. I mean, firstly, you I really love the fact that, you know, you made the class you know, come up and recite the Declaration of Kanban,
yeah,
essentially, at the, you know, that it's not a methodology in its own right, and you know, it's all those type of things, and you're not going to sell a certification, but it's a very misunderstood approach,
yeah.
Because it doesn't stand on its own 2 feet for a start. I mean, I spent a lot of time reminding people that, you know, you still got to do collaboration, which means the stand-ups make sense, and Kanban says nothing about retrospectives, but, you know, that's important, you know, for continuous improvement or some sort of, you know, something is built in. Do you get a lot of that in your travels, that people, their misunderstanding that, you know, perhaps Kanban should, you know, stand on its own right as methodology?
I think a lot. Almost everyone misunderstands this from the beginning, and I think it was because Kanban was pitched as an alternative to Scrum.
Hmm.
And basically, Kanban said, the early proponents of Kanban said, yeah, let's do away with all the Scrum practices. We don't need them. We just work. You don't really get the point, if I may say so, if you do that. So the one thing that makes me very trustworthy, especially when I talk with business, is the Kanban approach of start where you are. Change absolutely nothing. Limit the work in process, do the work, but limit the work in process, and then manage flow from ID to production. Those three simple principles make me very trustworthy when I talk with, because it's extremely undisruptive, right? Mm-hmm. It's very permissive, and we say, yeah, so you do this. I coached a team in one big insurance company in Sweden. It was a COBOL team. They were about 40 people. When they plotted out their Kanban board, or their process, which is really the thing, that's the process. Kanban is just a tool.
Mm-hmm.
And they plotted that out on the board for me. It was 40 stages.
Yeah.
And I said, great, guys, this is perfect. This is where, what we actually do. I'd much rather have 40 stages that says what we actually do than to do doing done that really doesn't say anything. So we started from there, and I wish I had a really good success story, but we made a lot of improvements and the flow was improved greatly, but it was not like an overnight thing.
Mm.
But that's not why we're here. The longer I'm in this business, the one word that really troubles me about Scrum is the word sprint.
Yes.
Because
that's run as fast as you can
for a short distance.
For a short distance, all year long.
Yeah, exactly. So no one would do like, what is it, 4,200 sprints to reach a marathon. You wouldn't do that. You jog away. It's very simple. One of my great and good friends and mentors in Sweden is called Torbjörn Gyllebring. He's an ultrathon runner. So he just completed a 200 mile run. That took like 43 hours.
He hasn't heard of a bus or a train.
No, exactly. I don't know. He's like crazy. But, and I just imagine what kind of speed do you keep them? So he said to me, yeah, keep the speed so you can have a conversation going very easy and relaxing. That's what we're aiming for, right? Usain Bolt, he's like doing, almost breaking his heart, like pushing him to the very, very limit to reach 100 meters below 10 seconds. You don't want that. He does a lot of stuff that is not sustainable over a longer period of time, even 400 meters.
Mm.
So we want sustainability, and yeah, we can keep doing this forever. This is easy, that level of speed. And in that, you will also have room for improvement. So there's a little bit of slack in there. Okay, perfect. That's exactly what we want.
That's something a lot of people forget, I think. That's one of the missing... And I think you may have mentioned this in your talk, is, you know, we went through this whole thing in Scrum of management by velocity, and, you know, the big stick out, if you don't get, you know, 3,727 points delivered this iteration or this sprint. But Slack's a very important part of part of there, and I think some people miss that. I mean, some people kind of go, "Yeah, let's put in 3 story points, or let's make our work in progress limit, you know, 200, so that we can build Slack into the process." But I think people misunderstand it. So, how do you explain Slack to people?
What I've done a couple of times, you know, as a formalized way of getting Slack into the system, is that we create a little column or a little part of our visualization or board with things that you can do if you have nothing to do. And then we leave that up to the developers, so, or the team, right? Mm-hmm. So whatever, what do you want to do? Yeah, we really need to upgrade the build server. No one would pay us for that.
Mm-hmm.
I have an idea on redrawing the board. So, and then I encourage people, once they finish a task, see if there's something you can do there.
Mm.
We try to keep them very small, things that we can do in half a day or a day maybe. And more often than not, I get buy-in from product owners for that, because they understand that you need to check that. But planning for Slack, that it's a little bit hard to swallow sometimes. So Slack will always occur.
Mm.
So for example, I'm blocked. I have to wait for something. Yeah, perfect. So maybe there's something here that you can do, or maybe you have another idea.
Mm.
Other ways to formalize it is, of course, that Fridays we do hackathons or things like that. And that we have seen over and over again that's where the real innovation happens for stuff that you might not really know. So. But I had a slide in the presentation yesterday, and it's in the book as well. It's like an indicator where I almost always trip up myself, an indicator on where your WIP limit is. So if your WIP limit is too high, you will see work that no one works on. That's not good.
Mm.
If the WIP limit is too low, you will see people with nothing to do. So it's work idle or people idle. And if people are idle, that actually is not a bad thing. First, it can foster collaboration, which is good, right? Or it's one of those times that you can do something to improve for us in general, right? So can we improve our process? And it can be simple things. Sometimes just move the board, maybe, or move the desks, or but just having that kind of breather of, I have some extra time now.
Mm.
So, I think it comes back to the reason people have a hard time with this comes back to that we want to like utilize our resources to the max. And that's super important if you want to maximize the number of keystrokes per minute.
Mm.
But most companies don't sell keystrokes per minute. They say sell IDs, realize that's features in production. And you need to think about that before, and then there's more thinking in Python.
That's right. And you know, we used to measure lines of code, but yeah. You know, actually we'd like to delete code. So.
Exactly. Someone said that yesterday. I don't know. Remember? Oh yeah, it was John Smart about BBD. He said you can't be more productive than not doing a feature.
So. That's right.
And he was bang on, because I've seen that a number of times when you do your scenarios and then you just realize this entire feature is not needed now. It's once we've done this, and they've talked through that before they even wrote the line of code, so they just throw that away, and all of a sudden, in velocity terms, we were super fast.
That's right. Absolutely. What other things have taken your interest? You mentioned impact mapping before, but what are things that are in the Agile community or practices that you see coming around?
I've read two books the last year that really blew my mind. And the first one is by David L. Marquis and called Turn the Ship
Around. Turn the Ship Around, yes.
Amazing book about leadership. And the other book...
It's actually in my bag upstairs.
Oh.
For the plane ride home.
I'm happy for you, sir. That's an amazing... Again, a really good story, right? It's a little bit messy. So it's not linear, but it's filled with stories like that. And I really love that story, because it talks about people being given authority and trust to act on their own on a nuclear submarine, mind you well. So you cannot get any more high risk than that.
Mm.
There's an amazing 10-minute TED talk like thing on YouTube that I encourage everyone to see on that. The other book is more of the same. It's called Reinventing Organization. It's a little bit older book, but I missed it for some reason. That book talks about the kind of next type of organization we see. So he makes a history, like a history odyssey of the kinds of organizations we have and how to progress. He calls them teal organizations because he classifies them in colors. I didn't even know that teal was a color, but I had to look that up, so I realized it's a kind of green, I think.
Yes.
That was very interesting, and I think that many of the organizations that I hear about, that we talk about, Atlassian, Spotify, these kind of organizations, they are aiming for this. They might not be 100%, but that's not important, but they are aiming for that. And it's again all about small teams with trust and authority to actually do something on their own.
Hmm.
So, and that was also very inspiring to me, especially the first chapter I love, because when he went through history, it made me realize what I've been frustrated about, especially in Indonesia where I am now, it's very old school kind of organization. So he Frederick, I cannot say his name, he's Belgian, Frederick Laloux, I think his name is pronounced. And what I liked about the book was that he was very unjudgmental, right? Because organizing like an army with a strict hierarchy, it has its place. If you have really simple tasks and building a wall, that's the perfect way of organizing. No talking back, just do. All right, we're putting these rocks on top of each other, let's go. But most things that we do require something else. It requires engagement, right? and some kind of using your brain to solve creative problems. And you can't do that by just telling people or hitting them harder, and then that doesn't work.
Mm.
So I really enjoyed those kinds of books. And these concepts is things that take up a lot of my energy. But I can never stop coding, so I'm much about that as well. But I realize that the things that I look for in every tool I'm working with is, to paraphrase Fred George here, is things that help me to move faster. So right now I'm into Node.js, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, why? Because I can make small things very, very fast. I can have the first prototype that I will show on the impact mapping.
Mm-hmm.
I can make that in a day if I want to.
Mm.
Because it's it's maybe 30 lines of code, and boom, I have the website.
Mm.
So, and because I was wondering why did I look at this, and it was, I realized that I heard that, yeah, they move really fast, so I was interested in that, and that's the thing that really tickles me right now. I want to reach that.
So, I guess finally, tell me a little bit about now you've sort of moved out of Europe. You're doing fabulous work with the Salvation Army, which is great to see in Indonesia. But you're out of this IT-centric world. But you know, tell us a little bit about some of the agile practices and how they apply to real-world problems, and particularly in an environment that I think we take for granted that in the IT world, even though we might be in very backwards organisations sometimes. You're going back to square one, I guess, in a lot of
places. Yeah, exactly. No, and I, that's been extremely enlightening for me. So the first thing is moving out of your own culture teaches you a lot about your own culture and yourself.
Hmm.
So what is the things that I'm really bothered with? They are exaggerated by 100 in Indonesia. So I get super frustrated. And I'm talking walking out of the room frustrated. But just by the fact that people don't send information.
Hmm.
I get response to 1 out of 50 emails I send. And that's driving me crazy still. I've been there 1.5 years and I'm still frustrated. So when you, like I did in one of our hospitals that was really struggling on a financial part, they were about to bankrupt. And basically what we did was that I put up a chart. I'll tell your user, your listeners now, but I'll show this in the Impact Mapping session later. We put up a chart visualizing how many patients do we need every day in order not to lose money. And that was one of the few moments in my career where I actually heard their jaws drop.
Mm.
There were about 80 people in the room and everyone was stunned. And I just, what just happened? This is the simplest form of diagram you can do. And it's super easy to track. We asked one guy to just count the number of people walking through a certain door where the patient came. And they were like, is this this bad? They required 120 and they were averaging on 60.
Yeah.
So I said, when we don't reach this line, we're losing money by having the hospital open that day. And so there's a 2 points to this. I think the first one is that it was visualized in front of us. That's something that we in the IT industry nowadays takes for granted.
Mm.
Everyone has a board. Yep, we didn't used to have a board. We used to, I don't even know how we remember how we did, but I remember coding of a fixed specification.
Yeah, fixed specifications and Gantt charts, right? In tools.
So, and the second is that the data made sense to them. They understood this data. It was easy to understand. And that's also something that we
do now. Well, you can't improve what you can't measure, right?
No, exactly, exactly. Before they were like, yeah, we need more patients, we need more rupees.
Mm. More money or more people.
Yeah, they didn't really see that transition. So making it simpler like that, I think that's one of the things. Also at the same place, we created a Kanban board for our initiatives to improve, and I invited the management team to a stand-up every morning. And those two practices are also things that are very, today, very taken for granted in our industry. But first, being transparent, showing what we work on, that was big news for them. And they were very worried about that first. And secondly, meeting every day, I had big flashbacks when people when they were just opposing that.
Yeah.
Because they felt, we're working here, man. We can't just be meeting. So it took me about 1.5 months before I actually got them to have short meetings.
Yeah.
So we're just checking, is it something that is not as it should? That's our focus in the morning. And I think, for myself, I just realized that this is things that I just, this is how you do it, right? But it's not.
Mm.
And it has nothing to do with IT.
Yeah.
The principles are the same. Right? The people want to know what's happening. They want to be transparent.
So what's your role there? I mean, I can't imagine you come in and say, hey, I'm an agile coach.
Yeah, no, exactly. Now, I call myself, actually, there's two parts to it. The first is, in order to be working in Indonesia, I need to be a social worker.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my official role.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a kind of a broad term.
But most agile coaches end up being social workers at some point anyways.
So. I love it. I'm keeping that on my work. But so what I actually do is more like management coaching, management consultancy. And that has to do not with the fact that they are bad managers, but according to Indonesian law, the director of a hospital has to be a medical doctor.
Yeah.
And the very few times that that's also a good manager.
That's right. Mm.
And then a good leader. So I try to help them along with that. But
was that something they knew they wanted, or was it something that you were able to give them because you were there?
No, they wanted that, and it has to do with the fact that this is related to Indonesian culture, but they don't work goal-oriented. I actually have a number of emails in my inbox saying, don't question the process. And I have one email that says, it's more important that we do it according to the process than that we do it.
Mm.
And this is in the Indonesian culture. And it's very easy, which I did, to say that they are stupid, but they are not. It's just that if they don't do that, we yell at them.
Yeah.
So we train them from a young age. A co-worker in my office told me that his father hit him if he asked why.
Mm.
So we need to go now. Why? Boom!
So you haven't gone and introduced some lean type five wise principles?
It's far.
Yeah.
Ask me again in 30 ugly. Years. No, so the main task I have to do there is actually to get them to implement strategic plans that operates from a vision. But in doing so, again, I just realized that even in our industry, even in Europe, even in Sweden, people might know the vision, but do you know how to act based on that vision? So given a certain opportunity, should you go left or right? Can the vision of the company actually guide you there? Maybe. I have not worked for things like that. Often it's just big, bold words and translating them down to something that actually is. I've talked to them, and this is interesting because I need to explain this to them. I also explain to myself. So I talk to them as I want them to have a compass. That's what I want the vision to be. Like, okay, we're going that way because of this.
Yeah.
So that you should be able to have this compass in your hand. And exactly at that point, impact mapping is really great too. Mm. It's perfect fit for them. So you want to do these things, why?
Mm.
And they get really frustrated with me because they don't ask why. That's one of the first words I learned in Indonesia, kenapa. Why? Why is it like this? Why do you do this? Do you know the reason for us going this way?
Mm.
And at first they don't really, there's no why should I, I'm not interested in the reasons. I'm just doing, here's my shovel, they shovel.
I guess it does make impact mapping a good tool because it starts with why, but essentially moves you along that to that impact thing. Whereas I think sometimes we, not finished with why, but it's closer to the end point. And impact mapping gets it out of the way in the beginning and then just focuses you more on the how and the actual capabilities you're going to...
Exactly. And very, very often people know the capabilities they want, but they don't know why. So I often find that it's easier to blurt out a couple of capabilities and then trace it backwards. But once you have... You should start with why. I'm not saying that it's not good, but once you have the board up, once I have the mind map up, rather, I always keep it up. And for the things we do, I might start our morning meeting by saying, okay, guys, remember the why, right? Trace back to this is the reason we're doing it. Let that be an inspiration. And maybe we can find things to do stuff more effective. Maybe we don't need to do stuff. Who knows, right? You can't make those decisions or weigh the options if you don't know why.
Hmm. Awesome. We've got plenty of conference to go on there, and I know you want to go and see some other things, but I could sit here for another hour talking to you about different things. But if people want to know more about you, I mean, you mentioned your blog, and where can they find you on this big wide internet?
Yeah, so I had a name that I got a couple of years ago. I was heavy into Microsoft before, so my name is actually Markusoft.
All right.
Markusoft.net.
They haven't come after you about that?
No.
Drink some Jack and Pinas.
I'm
good, thank you.
So, no, I registered Microsoft.net because that was the only one I could get, and I was like ready to to defend that, but they stayed on. Mm. And then I told my name when I registered, I was really proud, so I have Microsoft, cool, right? So I told a friend of mine that is not into IT, and she said, yeah, that makes sense, you're a soft guy. And so I said, ah. So I'm Microsoft.net on Twitter, and Microsoft.net is my blog, so you can find me there.
Cool, and lots of really great blog posts, and obviously the book Kanban in Action, which you can find through Manning and Amazon and wherever good books are sold, and probably some bad ones too.
Yeah.
Heading back to when we were in Perth at the moment, is this your first time to Perth?
Yeah, it is. I'm
for those who don't know, Perth is on the western coast of Australia, just in case you're not listening.
Yeah, exactly, and it's apparently one of the most remote cities there are.
Yeah, apparently the second most remote city in the world.
But I was very, very happy to come here for two reasons. It's been 1.5 years since I've been in a western city. Wide sidewalks, not people all over. So that was a very interesting experience. And it was cold. Yeah. I came out here and it was like 8 degrees. I was in flip-flops and shorts. So I had to go back in and put on pants, and that was also the first.
And now, having come from Sweden, you're gonna have to toughen up with you to go back home, aren't you?
It will be a hard summer. I'm telling you. We're going back for 3 weeks this summer, so that would be good.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, thanks very much. It's been great to meet you, and finally, great to get a face to a name. And thanks for all the work. We look forward to seeing more stuff from you, particularly as you do all that great work you're doing in Indonesia.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.